The story of four young men taken from Jerusalem to Babylon and the stand that they took there in Babylon. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and Daniel himself. They were only young, but they were men of God. And these men of God had to live in a pagan, anti-God society. And these four young men dared to take a stand in that society. They were determined not to start living like the Babylonians. They knew God's commands, and they were determined to keep God's commands, whatever the cost. When the king sent food and drink from his own table, food which God's law said that they mustn't eat, they were determined that they weren't going to eat it. They took a stand, and God honoured the stand. How did he honour the stand that these four young men took? Well, firstly, he gave them favour with the king. Everybody thought that on their vegetarian diet they would get skinny and haggard and feeble. But they didn't. They thrived. And academically they thrived as well. And when they were brought before the king, at the end of their 3 years of study, the king found that in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which he questioned them, they were 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. The king knew that he was dealing with exceptional men, men who were ready for key positions in his administration. That's the first way God honoured them. He gave them favour with the king. And then secondly, God prolonged their usefulness for many years to come. I guess many people will have thought that Daniel and his friends were heading for very short careers and perhaps very short lives as well. People who refused to go along with the king of Babylon, people who didn't fit in with the system, didn't usually survive very long. But we read in chapter 1, verse 21, that Daniel was there in Babylon until the first year of King Cyrus. He was there from the first year of Jehoiakim, that's chapter 1, verse 1, and we can date that, to the first year of Cyrus, and we can date that. And that means that he was there working in the heart of government in Babylon for 66 years. God kept him there because he was a man whom God could use, a man who could be trusted to put God's kingdom and God's commands first in every situation. We're going to see as we read on through Daniel that there were occasions when jealous rivals tried to stab Daniel and his friends in the back. And yet somehow, despite all their plotting and scheming, despite all the difficult situations that arose, Daniel and his friends were kept by God year after year. Other officials came and went. The Babylonian Empire itself came and went. And yet these men continued. They were faithful to God, and God was faithful to them. And then the third thing. The third way in which God honoured the stand that Daniel and his friends took. God enabled them to handle the crises that no one else could handle. God enabled them to handle the crises that no one else could handle. And you see the first example of that in the passage we read together this morning from Daniel chapter 2. Now, we're told that this episode happened in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Chapter 2, verse 1. That means that this must have blown up almost as soon as Daniel and his friends had finished their training. The year that Nebuchadnezzar became king of Babylon is known as his accession year. And that was the year when he besieged Jerusalem and took Daniel and company back to Babylon. That was the year when Daniel and his friends started their studies. The following year is counted as the first year of his reign. And that's the second year of their studies. And then the year after that is officially the second year of his reign, and it's the year when they complete their studies. So it's that year. It's the year that Daniel and his friends graduate. They're still very junior. It's in that year that Nebuchadnezzar the king, we're told, had dreams. Frightening dreams. The sort of dreams where you wake up shivery and shaky in the morning. We've all had dreams like that, haven't we? Now, not nightmares, where you're being pursued by monstrous creatures or where you're lost in the darkness or whatever it might be. But dreams that just leave you bothered and nervy and you're not sure why. And all day you're jittery. You've had dreams like that. But there was something more than that about these dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. They were so vivid. And they came back night after night. The same dream being repeated night after night. We know that from what's said when you compare verses 1 and 2. In verse 1 we're told he had dreams. But then in verse 2 he simply says, I've had a dream. He's having the same dream again and again and again. The same vivid dream that leaves him tense and scared in the morning. It was a scary thing for this great man. He reached a stage where he was frightened to go to sleep at night because he knew that the dream was going to come back once again. He'd lie awake at night going over the details of the dream, trying to work out what it meant. He knew it meant something important. He knew it was significant. You know, most dreams you can just shake them off in the end, can't you? And you say, well, look, it was only a dream. But this wasn't like that. He had the sense that this was a message. It was a message that he desperately needed to understand. But it was written in a code that he couldn't break. And it tormented him. I don't know how long Nebuchadnezzar carried on in that state. But I would guess it was over a period of weeks, maybe months. And I'm sure it began to affect his work. Maybe it began to affect his health. You can imagine him. He's the great God King. He's supposed to be all powerful, all knowing, all capable. And here he is appearing in the morning with great black rings round his eyes, looking as if he's not slept. Well, he hasn't slept. He just had perhaps that hour when he dozed off in the early hours and immediately found himself back in the same vivid dream again. You can imagine the courtiers in the palace whispering to one another, trying to work out what's wrong with their great master. There are rumours going around that he's coming to bits, that he's on the verge of a nervous breakdown. He's the most powerful man in the world. And he's scared out of his wits by something that he can't even put his finger on. And finally he cracks. Calls in a team of experts. And tells them, I've had a dream and it troubles me. Now that was quite an admission from the great king. His whole image, the image he tries to project, is of somebody who's invulnerable. Somebody who can handle anything. Somebody who doesn't get troubled about anything at all. He's supposed to be the embodiment of human greatness. He's a man who can solve any problem. He's the man who's going to solve all the world's problems. He's the man who expects people to worship him as if he were God. And here he is saying, something's happening to me and I don't know what it is. I'm frightened. I'm bothered. I've had a dream and I can't understand what the dream means. But it's left me troubled. God does this to people. He does it to individuals and he does it to societies. You've got somebody who thinks he's on top of everything. He's completely sure of himself. He's confident that he's the man with the answers. He's the man who doesn't need anybody else's help. And then something happens which shakes him. It may be some outward event. It may be an illness that comes without warning. It may be that his marriage breaks down. But something happens which shatters the illusion of being immortal and infallible and omnipotent. Or it may be something much more difficult to pin down. He starts having irrational fears. He starts feeling paranoid. He feels he can't trust anybody. He can't cope if the slightest thing goes wrong. He explodes at people with the slightest provocation. He lives with a nagging fear that something terrible is going to happen. But he can't imagine what. He can't understand why he's feeling that way. He's still in good health. He's still got a zero handicap on the golf course. Still earning a fortune. People who look at him think he's a success story in every way. But he's scared. And he doesn't know why. But the answer is simple. God is unsettling him. Just as God unsettled Nebuchadnezzar. God didn't need to use some huge disaster to unsettle Nebuchadnezzar. Didn't have to start a palace revolution. Didn't need to send Nebuchadnezzar some terrible illness. All he had to do was to send Nebuchadnezzar a dream. Night after night. To leave Nebuchadnezzar feeling vulnerable and scared and shaky. To destroy Nebuchadnezzar's illusion that he's in control. God did that for Nebuchadnezzar. God still does that for individuals today. And I believe God does that for whole societies at times. A society, a nation can go through a time of great prosperity. Perhaps great technological advance. There's a decade when everybody feels that we're surging forward. And there's great optimism and we're on our way to sorting out all our problems. And there's a sense of vibrancy and energy and confidence. And then suddenly it can vanish. And nobody's sure why. Industry is still booming, incomes are still going up, there are still brilliant composers and artists and entertainers around. But the mood has changed. And people are nervous. And there's an ominous feel as if there were thunder in the air. And everybody's worried and there's the sense that everything could go wrong at every time. And suddenly the whole of society seems to feel that life is fragile. And the politicians who were so popular a few months ago, suddenly people seem to have lost confidence in them. And instead of the positive, optimistic feel that was there, there's a sort of dread that hangs over everybody. And nobody can really pin down what's wrong. But there's a deep unease. I think it must have felt like that in the Babylonian court. During these weeks or months when Nebuchadnezzar was so troubled, people around him must have felt the vibes. And the feeling of unease must have spread through the whole court. I mean, everything depends on this great man. He's the boss, he's the great autocrat. And here he is looking suddenly very human and very shaky. As if he could come to pieces any moment. And if he comes to pieces, then the whole empire is going to come to pieces. It must have been a very strange time there in Babylon. Well, God does these things. God breaks up the foundations of human confidence. And when God breaks things, no one else can fix them. That's what we see here. Nebuchadnezzar, in this crisis, calls in all his wise men. He calls in his counselors, magicians and enchanters and sorcerers and astrologers. As one commentator puts it, these are the four faculties in the University of Babylon. These are the fields of knowledge that are most valued in Babylon. If you want a solution to your personal problems, if you want a solution to the problems of society, these are the men you call in. I suppose today Nebuchadnezzar might have called for the psychologists and the sociologists and the computer scientists and the economists. Here they are, all the experts. They all claim that they can see things and understand things that other people can't see. That they can see the patterns in nature. That they can see the hidden powers that shape events. That they can understand the hidden messages that are written in the stars. They claim that they're in contact with forces that can be channeled to solve human problems. And Nebuchadnezzar spells out to them his problem. I've had a dream, he says. I can't understand it. It bothers me. I want you to explain it to me. And he looks first at the astrologers. That's the word that's used in the NIV. Literally, the word is the Chaldeans. And it means the people who claim to be able to predict the future. If this is in anybody's department, it's in theirs. If his dream is a warning about the future, then presumably the Chaldeans will be able to explain it. Well, they say, no problem. Tell us the dream, and we'll explain it. And I'm sure they would have done as well. They'd have given him such a vague, ambiguous interpretation that it couldn't have been wrong. I mean, that's what fortune tellers have always done, isn't it? Today is a day that will bring great challenges. You will need to be careful to seize every opportunity and avoid mistakes, and you may well get a significant letter in the post. You know, you can't lose with a prediction like that, can you? Or maybe they'd have done something more risky. I mean, once they knew the details of the dream, maybe they would have given it a much more specific interpretation and then just hoped against hope that it would pay off. After all, this mood of Nebuchadnezzar's might well pass off if he stops having these dreams. And then he'll forget all about this whole business. He'll just be embarrassed even to remember that he called in the experts and can quietly be brushed under the table. Or maybe if the dream is a warning of some disaster that's going to come, well then maybe that means that Nebuchadnezzar won't be on the throne for very much longer anyway, and he won't be in a position to hold them to account. One way or another, they're sure that they can cook something up. Tell us the dream, they say, and we'll explain it. But Nebuchadnezzar, he may be on the verge of a breakdown, but he's no fool. No, he says, you tell me the dream. If you really are in touch with powers who can tell you secret, hidden things, then you'll surely be able to tell me what's going on in my own head. You'll surely be able to tell me what I dreamed. Well, these fortune tellers are horrified. And they protest. And the king gets more and more angry. And the other wise men from the other faculties, well, they're staying very quiet. And the king says, if you don't tell me the dream, I'm going to have you all chopped into small pieces. And the fortune tellers say, look, you're asking the impossible. What are they saying in verse 10, they say, "There's not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men." Here it is. Admission of total defeat from the experts. They've boasted about their great abilities. They've boasted about their mysterious understanding. But when it comes to this crunch point, they are totally helpless. They're forced to admit that their gods, the powers they call on, can't help in this crisis. They say the gods don't live among men. In other words, you can't actually look to the gods to do anything. They don't communicate with human beings. There's no way of making contact with them. They don't intervene in human affairs. There's no way that the gods can help in this situation. They're not here for us. Then what are these men in business for? If the gods don't speak to human beings, if the gods don't reveal anything to human beings, if they don't do anything for human beings, if they've got no contact with this world, then what's the point of all the years that these experts have spent studying and becoming experts in all these fields of magic, in all these skills for contacting the gods? They're helpless. They've set themselves up as great experts who have got the answer to everything. But now, when there's a real situation, now that there's a real problem, when you've got a king who's lost the plot and an empire that's cracking from the centre, they can't do anything. They can't even identify the problem, let alone solve it. Now, does that have a familiar feel to it? For 50 years, we've had a society dominated by experts. Every government needs to have a huge battery of expert advisors, the top academics from the universities, and the people who run the think tanks, the researchers. They're the qualified people. They're the people who have awarded each other PhDs and who organise conferences where they can clap one another and who can publish peer-reviewed articles. And they're making progress in every field, producing thousands of journals and endless books and endless research. They know more and more and more about everything. They understand the mysteries of the human psyche. They understand all the hidden trends in world economics. They understand it all, if you believe what they say. And they're there to advise our government. Here they all are, the sociologists, and the psychotherapists, and the economists, and the experts in technology, and all the subgroups, the educationists, and the criminologists, and the anthropologists, and the bioethicists. Here they are, experts on every side, to be consulted on every problem. Well, you would think, wouldn't you, that with all their expertise, with all the astonishing resources that are being poured into their research, and then being channeled into government thinking, with all the daily announcements of the result of this survey and this piece of research, you would think that under their guidance, our society would be marching onward to perfection. Wouldn't you? And what do we actually see? We see a society in desperate crisis. We see crime rates shooting off the scale, and shooting off is probably the right phrase. We see every prison place in the country filled, and violent criminals being released from prison and going back to commit more crimes, being released simply because there's no space left in the prisons. We see alcoholism becoming a national epidemic. We see psychiatric wards bulging at the seams. We see feral youngsters running wild on the streets, armed with knives and using them. We see sexually transmitted diseases spreading like a plague. We see 17 young people in one small Welsh town hanging themselves in just over a year. And the experts have got no answers. In fact, just like the experts of Nebuchadnezzar's day, they can't even explain what the problem is to us. With all their expertise, they can't even give us accurate statistics. How many crimes are being committed? How many folk are coming into the country needing to be housed and educated and cared for? 17 people kill themselves, 17 youngsters kill themselves in Bridge End. And the experts can't even explain why it's happening, what the common link is, what's driven these young people to that step, let alone offer a solution. The experts of Nebuchadnezzar's day, they say pathetically, what the king asks is too difficult. Then what have they wasted their lives for doing the research, if when it comes to a real problem they've got no answer at all? They're bankrupt. And that's what we're seeing today in our society. The bankruptcy of the intellectual elite. The people who pretended to be the experts. And it's in that situation that Daniel steps forward. The king, in his fury, orders that all the experts be executed. I feel some sympathy for the king at that point. Some of us have felt that way. But it's an indication of just how close the king is to breakdown. He really just is so close to panic. He just says, I want them all dead. Get rid of them all. And he means all. And that means that in the list of those who are going to be executed, there are four newly qualified, very junior, young government advisors. Daniel and his three friends. And so police come knocking at Daniel's door. They've come with a warrant to execute Daniel. Now Daniel doesn't panic. He asks what's going on. We're told that he asks with wisdom and tact. He's very courteous with the head of the guard who comes to arrest him. And the head of the guard explains what's going on. Remember that Daniel knows the king's guards. He's won their respect over the past 3 years. And Daniel listens. And then he says to the guard, well, let me go and see the king. And the guard agrees, because he knows that Daniel has had the smile of the king up until now. And Daniel goes to see the king. And Daniel asks for time to work on the problem. And the king agrees. And then Daniel goes and finds his friends, Daniel's band. And he says to his friends, we must pray. Verse 18, he urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. He says it's time for a prayer meeting. We must pray that God will reveal this mystery. Now that's the difference between Daniel and the wise men of Babylon. The Babylonian experts say the gods do not live among men. There's no way we can make contact with the gods. But Daniel and his friends know the real God. And they know that he can be reached. They know him as a God they can talk to. A God who can answer. A God who does intervene in this world, in answer to the prayers of his people. So Daniel and his friends pray. And that night, we're told, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And then Daniel breaks out into a song of praise. He said, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king." Oh, it's a song of God's sovereignty. He worships God for the fact that God is sovereign. The fact that God is in control of all things. He's the one who sets up kings, and he's the one who deposes kings. He really is in control of every nation and every emperor. He's capable of shaping what goes on in an emperor's mind while he's asleep. He's capable of lifting a man up or casting him down. And this God is sovereign in revelation. He's the one who can impart true wisdom and true knowledge. He can reveal deep and hidden things. And he's done that for Daniel. "You've given me wisdom. You've made known to me what we asked of you." And he's sovereign in answering prayers. "You've made known to me what we asked of you. We talk to you, the God of the universe. We talk to you, the sovereign God, and you listen to us." It's a wonderful thing for a believer when he asks for something specific from God and he knows that God has given it, that the great sovereign Lord of the universe has been listening to him personally. That's Daniel's experience. He's got a source of knowledge that these experts are cut off from. They've done an awful lot of research. They've stared up at the sky many times, checking the movements of the stars. But they don't know God. And Daniel does. Daniel is in contact. He has personal fellowship with the living God, the God of the whole universe, the God of past and present and future. He's Daniel's God. So Daniel goes to Arioch, the captain of the guard, and he says to him, "Look, you don't need to execute the wise men. Take me to the king. I'll interpret his dream." And Arioch straight away goes to the king, takes Daniel, and says, he's not a bit adverse to getting a bit of credit for himself, "I have found a man among the exiles who can tell the king what he wants to know." The king questions Daniel. "Can you explain to me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" And so Daniel begins to preach to the king. He doesn't launch straight into the dream. Doesn't start. He could have done. He could have started by telling the king immediately what he had seen in the dream. No, he starts by preaching to the king the reality of God. He's got a platform to do that now. he says, no wise man, no enchanter, no magician, no diviner can explain to the king the mystery he's asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. The wise men had talked about the gods, but Daniel says, there is one God in heaven. And the wise men of Babylon had said to the king, the gods who are in heaven can't communicate with men, and men can't communicate with them. They don't live among men. Daniel says, there is a God who speaks. There is a God who reveals mysteries. And that God has spoken to you, Nebuchadnezzar. For the first time, Nebuchadnezzar is confronted with the fact that there is a sovereign God who can invade his life whether or not he consents to it. The gods of the Babylonians are to be manipulated by proper sacrifices and proper formulae. But Daniel says to the king, look, the God who is in heaven is a God who can step into your life and who can speak to you, O king, without your consent. He's confronting the king with the real God, this proud man who has thought of himself as a God, who has thought of himself as omnipotent and infallible. He's been shaken by what's happened. And now Daniel is taking up the advantage of that. And Daniel is saying to him, look, you've been forgetting God. That there is one God, one true God, one sovereign God, and one God who communicates. And so he goes on to lay out the dream which the king has had again and again and again, and which has troubled him so much. And he goes on to interpret that dream. God willing, we'll go through the dream next week. It's a dream all about human pretensions, human empire building. In this dream, the king has been dreaming about himself and his own empire. And Daniel is going to preach to him the fact that that empire will not last, that that empire is going to fall, and that all the empires of men are going to fall, that every man who sets himself up as a king is going to be thrown down in the end. You know, another man but Daniel might have tried to play down some things in this dream, for fear of offending the king, to go to the greatest man in the world, the most powerful ruler in the world, and say, your kingdom's going to end. And everything you're trying to build is going to be shattered in the end. That's a risky thing to say, isn't it? But Daniel knows this is his moment. He's got the opportunity now to speak to the king, to confront him with reality. And to do more than that, he's got the opportunity to preach to him what God's ultimate purpose is. As he goes through the dream, as he explains it, finally Daniel says this. It's in verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. Daniel preaches to the king the coming of Christ. He says, when all human kingdoms have passed away, when all men's attempts to build empires for themselves have finished in the dust, then God is going to set up an eternal kingdom. A king raised up by God is going to reign, and he's going to reign forever. And nothing you do, Nebuchadnezzar, can prevent that from happening. All you can do is to submit to that king. Daniel knows what he's got to preach. He's got to preach the emptiness, the hopelessness of all human endeavours, of all human ambitions, of all human achievements. And he's got to take this opportunity to tell the king of Babylon about the King of Kings, about Jesus Christ, who is going to come and who is going to reign and who is going to reign forever. If you know Jesus Christ, and if you know what the Bible says about the return of Jesus Christ, you know more than all the experts of this world. The people who have spent lifetimes studying sociology and anthropology and economics and all the rest of it, they imagine that by their knowledge they can somehow bring in utopia. You know that it's a nonsense. You know that it's a lie. You know that there's only one person who is going to heal this world, and that is Jesus Christ. You know that he's coming again. You know that he's going to reign forever and ever. You know that one day all the kingdoms of this world are going to become the kingdoms of the Lord and of his Christ. That's the message that we've got to shout to a society that's shaky and that's frightened and that's disintegrating. When all the experts have failed, we are the people who can go to the men and women around us and say, this is where truth is found, from God. And this truth is about Christ and his kingdom.